let's be absolutely clear. We've got a problem with racism, and the conflict in our society around race is caused by racism, not by our response to it.
Well, hello everyone and welcome to another episode of Australian Politics Live. I'm Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia, and I'm also the host of this show. This week, my guest is Tim Soutphommasane. Many of you will know Tim already, but for the listeners who don't, he's a political theorist and human rights advocate. He was formerly Australia's Racial Discrimination Commissioner. These days, he's off thinking about politics at Sydney University. This week, we're talking about race politics, media organisations monetising hatred. We also consider whether or not the recent tragedy in Christchurch can reset public debate as we head for the federal election. Listen up. All right. So can I start with your own experiences of racism? You've recently written a little book called On Hate. Well, I suppose it might be a bit twee at one level to start with the personal, but I always think it's interesting.
I grew up as part of a migrant family in Sydney. We came here when I was 3 years old, and I came of age really in the 1990s when you had Pauline Hanson in her first incarnation. And when Pauline Hanson in 1996 gave her maiden speech to Parliament and warned about Australia being swamped by Asians, she was talking about people like me and about people like my family. So this wasn't an abstract or academic issue or a debating point for me to think through. This was deeply confronting at a personal level. I went to a high school that was predominantly Anglo-Celtic in composition, which was a dramatic change from the primary school that I went to, where a vast majority of students were from migrant and non-English speaking backgrounds. And I did experience some racism during those years at school. It was nothing physical, but it was certainly verbal. There'd be comments said in the playground or in the quad, sometimes in the classroom. And usually it took the variety of people saying things within earshot to try and provoke a response or get under your skin. No one ever really directly confronted me to tell me that they believed they were a member of a superior race. Racism came in a more subtle, casual, everyday form. And this is the kind of racism that many others would have experienced growing up as well. And people have different responses to it. Some will try and brush it aside. In fairness, as a teenager, that's probably the response that I had, because you don't want to get into a fight every day, or you don't want to make yourself a bigger target. But that was an early lesson in of course, what it's like to be sometimes the target or someone on the receiving end of racism. And going to the last 5 years that I had as Race Discrimination Commissioner, there wasn't a day that went by when I didn't have to think about racial discrimination or hatred in some shape or form. We would get almost daily reports of incidents that would come through to us from members of the community, or we'd pick it up through the media. There was the correspondence that I would receive, which would range from agreement and support to mild criticism to sometimes personal and racial abuse. So this is part of the job that I had, and it's the kind of exchange that you would expect for someone involved in anti-racism to experience. And I knew about this perfectly well before I took on the job in 2013, because I knew that one of my predecessors in the office was the subject of some very serious and credible threats. There was a bomb planted under her house that was discovered by authorities. And that's the kind of risk that you've got to weigh up before you take on a job that involves confronting racism and extremists of the far right and white supremacist kind.
And do you think that over time you've developed coping mechanisms yourself that sort of doesn't allow you to internalise it, allows you to externalise it? Obviously, you've got a mission as a human rights advocate, and that's a good way to direct your energies. But without getting too Dr. Phil, How do you deal with this? How do you separate it? How do you stop it from making you deeply anxious?
You need to have a thick skin, and it's the kind of job that isn't for everyone. I know, for example, that when I was close to finishing up my term, that there were quite a few people who considered putting their hand up and applying for the job but were deterred precisely because they believed that they may not be able to cope with the racism that might be directed at them and the personal attacks that might be directed at them. I was fortunate in getting a good training and having a thick skin, both through my own personal experience growing up, and also I think through the early forays I had into opinion journalism when I had a regular column in the Weekend Australian for a few years when I came back from England. And I was the recipient of regular hate mail from the Australian's readers. And that was a good testing ground for me and a good way for me to get accustomed to the idea that debates are going to be raucous to some degree. There's going to be disagreement, and some people feel like they have to put you in your place if you are too vocal on certain issues, including on race.
Mm-hmm. Let's get to race and politics now, which you've been trying to raise national consciousness about for your entire time in as Race Discrimination Commissioner, and obviously before that. But you've been warning for years that race politics is on the march again. I want to talk through what are the underlying causes that's driving this dimension of our politics and politics that we see in Western democracies elsewhere. What's going on?
We're seeing liberal democracies in the West dealing with the challenge of having a pluralistic population. The model of a nation state in historical terms has assumed that there'd be a homogenous people, that people would share the same background, have the same race or ethnicity, and that was bound up in this idea of a nation. Obviously, mass immigration since the post-war years in Australia's case has meant that our population is not by any means homogenous. And we've had, over the decades, the development of multiculturalism as a policy to respond to this. But clearly, there are still elements in society who may feel some discomfort about and anger about what's happening to their society and population. Now, for the most part, people in Australia are comfortable and relaxed about our diversity and multiculturalism. But there is a small rump of society that isn't so comfortable and so relaxed. What you've had on top of that are sections of the political class and also sections of the media who've really sought to work up a sense of anger and resentment about change in society, about an evolving national identity, about the changes we see in our neighbourhoods. This has been mingled up as well with debates we've had about population growth, congestion in our cities, the quality of life, housing affordability.
You made a point in a recent speech, there was the Curtin Lecture, I think, that the point about hatred and the point about the rise of racism is that it threatens democracies. You know, I think a lot of people listening to our conversation would think racism, you know, hate speech, it's something they don't like to hear. It's something sort of discordant or inconvenient or a bit gross or whatever else. But they wouldn't necessarily draw the link between liberalism and hatred and racism, which you have sought to do explicitly. So tell people about that. Why does this sort of speech and these sorts of attitudes threaten democracy?
It does because it challenges our values as a society. And racism isn't only an issue we should care about because it affects minorities or those who are vulnerable. If we're not careful in how we deal with racism, we could be eroding the values of equality and justice and non-discrimination, which helped define what a liberal democracy should mean. Now, I referred earlier to the casual and everyday forms of racism that can exist in society. What we're seeing is, on top of that, political expressions of racism, where there are appeals in public debate to division or to ethnic and racial identity. And it's that aspect of the public debate that really raises the question of democracy's stability. And it's no accident that the rise of racism today and the rise of race politics today is bound up in the emergence of national populism or nationalist populism. And this is about illiberal forms of democracy. Some of the most influential practitioners of nationalist populism have used this very phrase themselves. I'm thinking of Viktor Orban in Hungary, for example, or if you think about the United States, where Donald Trump's rise to the White House has been closely linked to the emergence of an alt-right movement calling for the establishment of a white ethno-state. These are direct challenges to liberal democracy in representative form as we know it today. What is present in the political discourses is an idea that you've got to redefine the state so that it's defined in ethnic terms or in racial terms, which excludes certain people by virtue of their race and religion. And that, to me, is a fundamental challenge to the idea that in a liberal democracy, members of that society belong regardless of their race or their religion or their background.
So it's sort of, it's that fracturing both at a level of values and at a societal level that it's corrosive in that sense, that that you know, it sort of strikes right at the heart of, you know, of how democracies see themselves.
Yes, and if you normalise ideas of racism or hatred and believe that it's acceptable to entertain extreme ideas, that has a democratic implication. Think of it this way. Most reasonable people wouldn't believe that it's appropriate for us in a democratic society to give equal time to Islamic terrorists or give equal time to pedophiles in public debate. Yet if you listen to the debates we're having around race and immigration, you do get the impression that there's a section of the community out there, including progressive-minded people sometimes, who believe that it's okay to give equal time to white supremacism because you've got to debate those ideas. Well, it's curious that that logic isn't applied to certain forms of extremism, but yet is applied to forms of extreme nationalist populism or white supremacy, which have as their goals the very undermining of liberal democracy as we know it.
Can I put that back to you in a slightly different way? I know what you're saying, but for example, from a journalistic point of view, with white supremacists, with white nationalists, in the disrupted digital age, these folks do have open channels of communication with their audiences. They do have a Steve Bannon figure has, you know, a whole news organisation has the capacity to basically communicate via an open microphone. The point of engagement with white supremacists is not that we want that people want to hug white supremacists. It's providing some sort of disruption between them promulgating their views and an audience and viewers. Do you think that's misguided? Do you think that's a bit of journalistic misguidedness, if that's even a word?
That's great in theory, but let's look at it in practice, and that's the real test. Are people being subjected to the kind of scrutiny that you're highlighting? Because if the idea is that you need to scrutinize and challenge ideas of an extremist kind, and then you can make an argument for that. But let's go through some specific examples to see how well this plays out in practice. I think of the Four Corners interview that Sarah Ferguson conducted with Steve Bannon, where the interviewer there explicitly said, "Now, Mr. Bannon, I know you're not a racist," or something to that effect. That to me isn't challenging the likes of Steve Bannon. That's giving them a free pass. That's legitimating their ideas. And that's not the kind of scrutiny that I would have expected of a hard-hitting interview. I'll give you some other examples. Think of just recently the ABC live streaming a press conference that Fraser Anning held, and the news director at ABC, Craig McMurtry, within a day came out and acknowledged that was an error of judgment. And I think the acknowledgement was about the important need to scrutinise and challenge extremist views rather than giving it free time or an easy platform. And think of the commercial media channels as well on television. Think of Channel 7 and Sunrise and the platform they've given to Pauline Hanson over many years. Now, it appears that there are some in Channel 7 who are now acknowledging the damage this is being done. I think of what David Koch did in challenging Pauline Hanson a few days ago. But all of us watching this are asking, why the hell didn't that challenge exist at any stage over the past 3 years? Why did it have to wait until something like Christchurch happened before there was this this belatedly discovered need to scrutinise and push back on Hansenism and on white supremacy? So while in theory it may make sense to say that you need to have people in mainstream media platforms so that you can scrutinise and challenge them, I don't see it being done in the way that you'd expect right now.
Yeah, but is there a difference? Now, you've raised Sarah Ferguson's interview, which was a contentious interview, and I still am of the view that you interview Steve Bannon rather than not. Now, you and I might disagree on this point, but I'm still of the view you interview him. You can take issue with, you know, how expertly or otherwise that interview was done, for sure. But do you see a material difference between a current affairs type interview and Pauline Hanson on Dancing with the Stars, for example?
Well, one is news and current affairs and one is entertainment. And I would hope that those who work in news and current affairs as journalists are held to a more exacting standard than those who are hosts of entertainment shows. But in the examples I've noted, we're talking very strictly here about journalists and current affairs. Now, for one, haven't said that there should be a blanket rule which should prohibit people from interviewing or mentioning or talking about extremists, because I accept that there's a need to challenge ideas. The question is that being done? And I think if you're asking softball questions, or if you are perceived or interpreted as making active excuses to let people off the hook, or taking chummy photos with extremists when you've conducted a supposedly hard-hitting interview, the reasonable viewer or citizen is entitled to ask, have you done your job properly? To make clear here, this is a criticism of someone who's regarded as one of our leading and most incisive journalists. And this just illustrates the depth of the problem or issue here. If even our best journalists may need to be criticised from time to time, that does highlight how difficult it is to get this right. And I commend what Craig McMurtry did earlier this week in acknowledging and speaking very openly, because I don't think you're going to see positive change or improvements to the coverage we have of race issues unless there's some level of introspection and a preparedness to acknowledge that there's room for improvement.
I'm certainly not saying to you that there's no room for improvement and that there's nothing to see here. That's not my point. It's sort of a professional debate about whether or not people are deplatformed, for want of a better term, or whether or not there is any value in trying to interrogate their ideas. I don't think you and I actually have a fundamental disagreement.
And I think it's about the default with which you begin. And in my view, the default should be, we should scrutinise every idea that comes through. The default sometimes, as it appears, or the impression you get, though, is that, well, every idea needs to be given a platform. There's a nuance in that, I think. If you wanted to...
Yeah, it, yeah, well, it's... it's an important one, actually, because I'm certainly not of that view. I'm certainly not of the false equivalence view that a dumb idea needs to be given equal time with a good idea, or a fact needs to, or an untruth needs to be given equal time with a truth. That's sort of that false balance notion has kind of led journalism into perdition on a range of fronts. That's not my view, but it's sort of there is this live current, I suppose, in cultural debate about deplatforming versus interrogation. And, you know, I'm a journalist. You'd expect me to come down on the interrogation side, not in some mindless, we're all perfect, thanks very much, go away, Tim, frame of mind. That's not what I'm saying at all. But I'm personally discomforted by deplatforming.
Yeah, yeah. And I would add to all of this that there's an important need to refocus journalists' attention to ensuring that underrepresented voices are also given a platform here. So one way of countering or guarding against this kind of racial blind spot in the coverage of issues is to ensure that, well, you know, in the spirit of scrutinising ideas and ensuring that we have a healthy public debate, if you're talking to neo-Nazis or figures of the alt-right, make sure you also talk to those who are affected by their discourse. Talk to those who are targeted by racism. Make sure that their voices are heard as well. So, you know, if, for example, you're talking to a Steve Bannon or a Blair Cottrell, make sure that's balanced by a voice that is representative of someone who has to bear the brunt of the free speech that's just been exercised.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you can't sort of view it in isolation. You can't view it as not consequential, what these people say. And in my own view, journalistically, and this was the position I adopted during the RDA debates, the Racial Discrimination Act debates, for those who don't speak acronym, is that, you know, I might take a free speech view and that might be fine for me professionally as a journalist, but I wouldn't assert that view over the lived experiences of people from different ethnicities who had been subject to the most horrendous racial prejudice. I think if you're trying to balance those two propositions, the people who have been subjected to racial prejudice, their views carry more weight than mine. They do, because they have to live with the consequences. These things are sort of, you know, are balancing acts all the time, really. I don't think my right to, have free expression trumps the right of somebody else not to feel like they want that they're marginalised, they're scapegoated, and they're anxious to a point where they can't walk out their front door. I mean, that trade-off is ludicrous in my view, but you've got to sort of walk yourself to that trade-off, which is your point. You've got
That's right. And I think you've described it in the right way, which is to say that there's no trumping of anyone's rights here. It's about the balancing of people's rights. And everyone's got a right to freedom of speech, but people also enjoy a right to be free from discrimination and from vilification and a freedom from violence. And they're the freedoms that you need to balance. And I think that's the kind of balancing that journalists need to do to model this civic exercise in our democracy if we are to be a healthy democracy.
Yeah. Now, let's. I want to come back. There's a final pass we need to do at the media, but I want to come back just to our political debate at the moment. Now, pre-Christchurch, you and a number of others were pointing to the prospect of a race-based election in Australia with the kind of soul-destroying debate about boat arrivals as the sort of proxy, as always, around which this whole discussion turns. Now, we've obviously had this horrific incident in New Zealand, absolutely horrific incident, which has created such shock and horror in the community. Do you think that changes the tenor of the political debate we're going to see in the election or not? What do you think?
I hope it does. And I hope that it does create an opening for a reset of our political response to racism and white supremacy. The majority of Australians would have been horrified and appalled by what happened in New Zealand. And many of us would have felt the attack in New Zealand as though it were an attack on Australia and on Australians. But if we are going to reset, our leaders need to grapple with the causes of racism and extremism, and they've got to work on the fundamentals. If you want action to stem extremism and hate speech, let's see some funding given to a strong national anti-racism campaign. Let's see some action taken to strengthen hate speech laws. Let's see action taken to focus on the de-radicalisation of far-right violent extremists in the way that we focus attention on Islamic extremism. And let's see a stop to ceaseless race politics. The last few years have not seen action on any of these things. We've seen instead direct attacks on the Racial Discrimination Act and our race hate laws. We haven't seen any significant investment into anti-racism activity at a programmatic level. And to put this in a perspective, the issue should be pretty simple to deal with. We put tens of millions of dollars in Australia to education campaigns on smoking, on seatbelts and road safety, on domestic violence. And we all regard those things as important. I think they're important. But we have close to zero allocated nationally to conducting educational campaigns on racism. And at this particular time, there is an urgent need for our leaders and for governments to be thinking seriously about committing themselves in that way.
Do you think Australian politics, in a way, is addicted to this sort of racial undercurrent? Is it sort of helpful to think about it as an addiction?
Perhaps. The evidence suggests that people, at least some sections of the political and media class, find it very difficult to go cold turkey on race politics. We had two attempts, after all, to repeal Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act. And it's not as if we've not had debates in the past where people have called for a stop to the racialization of sentiments. I mean, think of what happened in the form of the Cronulla riot and the public response to what happened there and the incitement of hatred that was being conducted by sections of the media. That was a challenge for us to do better. And yet we're here in 2019. It seems like we haven't learned the lessons of conflict and of racial hysteria. And if anything, things have only got worse. I think of what happened last year in 2018 and drawing up a catalogue of how things played out. I mean, right at the start of the year, you had a panic about African crime and senior government ministers declaring that it was unsafe for Melburnians to go out and have dinner. You then had parliamentarians within the national parliament rehearsing white supremacist slogans, using Nazi language, calling for the final solution. And what's worse is, you know, Fraser Anning gave his final solution speech in parliament, and there was a line of government senators congratulating and others congratulating him. Pauline Hanson moved her It's Okay to Be White motion, and that was supported by 23 government senators. The evidence suggests that there is something of an addiction to race politics, but it's time to break that addiction if there is one.
Why do you think, if we're defining it as an addiction, why do you think it's there? Why do you think it exists?
I haven't really thought of it as an addiction until you've put it to me. But hey, you look at the evidence, and there are clear signs of repetition occurring. Why is it happening? Well, maybe it's because our political class is not as representative or as reflective of our multicultural society as it should be. And that's surely got something to do with this, because if you're able to regard race issues as an abstract thing, as not affecting you or your wife or your husband or your sisters and brothers or your children, if you can take a certain luxury in having the distance and dealing with this as a topic of a salon debate, then you can afford to be callous. But if you've got skin in the game, if what you're talking about is going to affect your family in a direct way, I suspect you might get a different tone to our public debates. And this isn't just speculation, the talk about a lack of diversity in our parliament. We know, looking through the 226 representatives there in the House of Representatives and in the Senate, that we don't have anything near the 24% that exists in the general population who have a non-European or Indigenous background.
Yeah, I agree. It's got to be part of the story. Now, just quickly, because time's against us, we could seriously go on, I think, for an hour, you and I, on this subject, but we need to be a little bit attentive to time. Just final pass at the media, this your curtain lecture, which I think I referenced earlier, and this tendency of media organisations in our very disrupted media landscape to become more tribal. You described it as monetising hatred, the sort of the business model for disrupted media companies. Let's unpack that slightly. What do you mean by that?
Well, it goes back.
I mean, and we're talking here more broadly than whether Koshy shirt fronts Pauline Hanson or whether you know people put her on Dancing with the Stars or whatever. We're talking about a broader trend here, right?
It is something potentially systemic in that we're talking about the imperative to hold on to audiences. We're talking about the need to have people clicking on your websites. We're talking about the need for people to tune in to your radio show, to buy copies of the newspaper, whether I suppose in hard form or electronically these days. So the point about the monetization of hatred is that it's not just an ideological position. It's not just born of the particular editorial line that a newspaper or a particular outlet may have. It's also bound up in the commercial viability of those organizations and the need for them to hang on to their audiences. I don't think a lot of the racism that we see in public discourse, particularly in our media, is necessarily about attracting new audiences to platforms. It's about hanging on to those audiences because you've got the proliferation of news sources and entertainment now. People don't need to read a newspaper or tune in to the 6 o'clock bulletin on TV in order to get their daily news. All you've got to do is whip your phone out of your pocket or your handbag and go through it, and you can see it on Facebook or other social media. And that's a direct challenge to the commercial viability of our traditional news platforms. And I think the focus on racialized conflict is a manifestation of some of those commercial pressures mingled with the ideological expressions of those outlets.
And it sort of, well, it kind of brings us to the sort of landing point of the whole conversation. Are you hopeful? Do you maintain hope that with all of these cross currents, you know, that we've defined over this conversation, right? We've had the sort of the impact of the global financial crisis, the backlash against globalization, the retreat into these sort of the sort of psychic comfort of monocultural single nation states, the disruption in the media landscape where businesses are chasing engagement from audiences, therefore paying customers, and the principal currency of that is emotion from the point of view of media companies. Looks pretty bleak, doesn't it?
It does at one level, but you've got to retain hope. We've got no choice but to retain hope. We can't give up on democracy. I, for one, believe that you get the governments and the democracy you deserve. And good citizens right now need to demand better democracy and better government. And that must involve less race politics, less fear, less hatred, and less division. People shouldn't underestimate the power that they have to shape things. And it's easy to wallow in despair or think that we can't get out of this, but I think we can if people decide to speak up, because there is in my view, a majority that is dissatisfied with the nature of our politics and doesn't like race politics, but they've got to use their voice to put pressure on politicians and also on media to change their ways here. And the stakes are very high. I don't think the race politics we're seeing at the moment can just be conveniently explained away as a as an episodic venting of cultural or racial anger. I don't believe that you've got to indulge this in order for it to pass through the system so that you can then quietly reset in a few years' time. History tells us that if we're not careful, nationalist populism can in fact be a prelude to something much darker. And when democracies fail, they don't fail necessarily from some outside force coming in. They fail because it implodes, or they fail because democratic mechanisms get used for non-democratic and illiberal political purposes. That's the history of fascism. Fascism was enabled by democratic mechanisms. If you look at the prototypical fascist regimes in the form of Mussolini or Nazi Germany, those two examples occurred through democratic means. And that's why we've got to be on guard against the rise of race politics and hate today.
But ultimately, those movements, I mean, I would like Tim to bottle your positivity, frankly, and just keep it in a little shrine at my desk. Or you're saying we all have to keep showing
absolutely.
Up. Absolutely. We have a contribution to make. But if we look to history, it ended badly, this trajectory, didn't it? It ended badly.
And it ended badly because people didn't exercise their responsibility. It ended badly because otherwise good citizens were indifferent or complacent. And that, to me, is the imperative today, to make sure that we don't ignore the lessons of history and that we push ourselves and those around us to exercise our civic and our patriotic responsibility to defend our country and to defend our democracy against extremist elements.
And let's end this way. That's positive. Suggest to people an individual action they can take to avoid the slide into horror that we're talking about.
Think about the next time you hear people talking about racism and anti-racism. Whenever someone says that anti-racism is divisive or that calling out racism creates more harm than good, that's your chance to speak out, because those ideas are talking points which can creep into normalization of hatred. This idea that conflict is generated by us calling things out. Well, let's be absolutely clear. We've got a problem with racism, and the conflict in our society around race is caused by racism, not by our response to it. And that, I think, is a responsibility that everyone in our society can exercise in the conversations they have.
Good note to end on. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, Catherine.
Thank you so much, as always, for listening. We really do appreciate it. Thank you, as always, again, to Miles and to Hannah for production. Remember to leave ratings and reviews and download the series, subscribe. If you like the listening, please do all those things. Tell your friends about it, all of that sort of stuff. The political season is well and truly hotting up in Canberra. The budget is breathing down our necks, and we are almost in an election. I really pause as I say that, but it's actually true. We're almost there. So we'll be back next week with all the bits.